in the audience too. I'm going to go ahead and call. I'm going to go ahead and call the special committee on energy to order at our after 11, 12:31 p.m. or a.m. It's p.m. On Tuesday, April 16th. Members present, we've got Representative Rauscher, Representative Zolkowski, Representative Sponholz, and myself, Representative Greyer Hopkins. Let the record reflect that we do, in fact, have a quorum, and there's lots of other meetings going on. Assisting us today and our recording secretary Butch Carver and our LIO moderator Eileen Kahn.
My committee, Joe Hardenberg, is also with us today. Anybody have any questions before we get started? Just let the record reflect also that Representative Pruitt has joined us as well. We're going to be having an overview today from Mira Kohler, who's the CEO of the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, about the All Alaska Energy Project and a vision for how Alaska's natural gas resources can be harnessed to provide lower cost power to Alaska's communities in a different way than we heard from Mr. Pursley before. Ms. Kohler, would you go ahead and come join us? And to me, okay if we interrupt with questions throughout? All right, thanks. So just let me know if you have any questions. And please go ahead and put yourself on the record, and you can give your presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Mira Kohler, and I'm the president and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Co-op. I would like to thank you once again for allowing me to present to your committee. This is, in my opinion, one of our more important committees, and what I'm going to talk to you about today is a project that actually AVEC has been shopping and pursuing for several years now, and I'm hoping that maybe this year we'll actually break through and get started on it. So just a quick overview of Alaska Village Electric Co-op. I know I did this just a couple of weeks ago, but we are a not-for-profit electric utility. We are headquartered in Anchorage. We serve 58 communities around the state. A total of 32,000 Alaskans receive electricity from us. It's about 38% of the total population that receives power cost equalization. So we have 50 power plants around the state. We have we primarily burn diesel. We use about almost 9 million gallons of diesel a year. We also have 36 wind turbines that serve 20 communities. We also own two tugs and barges that deliver most of our fuel to our villages. Quick overview of where we are. You can see that we have Yakutat down in southeast. We have Gamble in the west. Between those two communities is over 1,000 miles. And from Kivalina to Old Harbor, north to south, is about 800 miles. So that's a pretty large area to hop around between. We sell about 118 million kilowatt hours a year, which sounds like a lot, but if you compare it with a utility like Chugach, we're about 8% of what they sell in one community or their communities. The average cost of power in rural Alaska is very high. The consumption is very low. Our average monthly residential user only uses 397 kilowatt hours. We represent about 41% of all PCE that's dispersed. And it comprises about 21% of our gross revenue. So this is a picture that I took from the 2011 Alaska Power Statistics that was put together by ICER. There has also been a 2012 report, but it's almost identical to this, so I haven't tweaked this. We have not had another Alaska Power Statistics since that time, and I'm hoping that that happens in the not-too-distant future. What this shows you at a glance is the total revenue that is received by electric and gas utilities for energy, and how much is spent on diesel fuel around the state. So taking a ballpark value of diesel at $4 a gallon, which is a little high for Fairbanks, it's a little low for the villages, but on the whole it averages out. Alaskans spend more than $3 billion a year on electricity and heat. In 20 years, that's over $60 billion. That's a lot of money that for the most part is going to outside owners of gas resources and fuel refineries and so forth. So what we have been talking about is an Alaska grid. What we lack in this state, and that makes us unique in the United States, is that we do not have a transmission grid that connects the state. What we are proposing is that very large scale, very high efficiency gas fire generation be developed on the North Slope. The primary user at first would be the producers themselves, the oil producers themselves, but there would be more than enough electricity to be able to ship it around the state to major hub points. And the way that you would do that is using the technology that's known as high voltage direct current technology. Conventional electric utilities operate with alternating current transmission because they're primarily shipping power shorter distances, and they can afford to correct the imbalances that are created by AC power. DC power can go very long distances with very low losses. The only challenge is that converting it back and forth between AC and DC can be a challenge, but technology has gotten to the point where that has become relatively inexpensive, and so it's becoming the transport mechanism of choice around the world. So what that would do for the entire state is it would create much lower emissions because you're using high-efficiency natural gas. You would have abundant power for not just North Slope, but for Fairbanks and other rail belt communities, for mines, processors, military, and for heat and power for rural communities. So HVDC has actually been a technology that's been in use since 1954. This is just a quick overview of projects that have been around for a long time. I point out the Pacific Intertie, which is the Washington to California HVDC Intertie. It's 850 miles, and it's been in operation since 1985. And it moves power both ways. In the summer, when there is an abundance of hydroelectric power, they ship it south to California. In the winter, when you have a need for heat in the Pacific Northwest, they get power up from California. So it moves both ways. And this has been a very efficient form of transporting electricity. So this is what DC versus AC looks like. The picture in the middle right, you can see a 3,000 megawatt DC line. And then you see a side-by-side footprint of a 400-megawatt AC line. It shows you that, relatively speaking, for the same footprint, you can ship about 7 to 8 times the amount of power that you can using AC. In the upper left-hand corner, you have a project in South America where you are serving two countries, basically Brazil and Venezuela, with power from a hydro project over there. And you can see the comparison of the two types of lines. And then in the lower left, you see the project in China, which is a Three Gorges hydro project, which is a 25-gigawatt hydro project. You can see the difference in the footprint for an HVDC line versus an AC line. It's much, much smaller. The other thing I need to point out is when you have an AC line, you'll see that you have those three little hanging thingamajigs. There's a wire in each one of those. That's for three-phase power. On the DC line, you'll see just two poles, and those are actually independently operating wires, so you can move your entire output on one or the other. If one of those wires for some reason is disabled or has to be taken out of service, the other one is still fully in service. Whereas an AC transmission, if one of those wires is taken out of service, the entire pole is down because you can't use it with just two phases of power. So there's a big difference there. So just a quick look at HVDC connections that are taking place around the world. I will point out to you that these next few slides, except for one of them, are 5 years old. And I really need to get the ABB to update them to show you the new grids that have been put in place. And so my next presentation will show you projects built since this time, which is much greater than what you see over here. But entire countries are being connected with DC because it's a practical way to connect communities and countries. You see what we have in North America, nodes in the United States, and quite a bit of utilization in Canada. I have a specific slide for Manitoba. Manitoba Hydro is considered one of the major developers of HVDC projects in the world. And so they have in recent years just completed a major project of HVDC that takes power now from South Manitoba and all the way into the United States. So we're feeding in power into the United States from Canada using direct current lines. And I also need to point out that a large component of the HVDC lines in Canada have exactly the same construction country climate that we have, which is the permafrost and Arctic conditions. So it is entirely feasible in Arctic conditions. And I see we have a question.
Yeah, thank you. Are the HVDC lines buryable, or do they have to remain above ground?
They are indeed not only buryable, but that's a development of choice for some areas. So, for example, there's a company called Green Energy, and they have built HVDC, and it is buried. And it's going 600 miles, I believe, from West Texas, coming to the east to deliver power from renewables to places where the demand is. So, yes, not only is it suitable for burial, it's also suitable for submersible cable. You have a practical limit of how far you can push electricity on AC submersible cable. With HVDC, it's almost unlimited. So it is what is used, for example, when I was in Norway a few years ago, they deliver power to this island where they're doing their oil and gas development with a submersible HVDC line. I added a little bit to this particular slide. Previously, we would just talk about Jingshaba Shanghai, which is the 1,250-mile tie line that's moving 6.5 gigawatts of power, and that's been commissioned since 2010. In the next few years after that, they have built another 13,000 miles of HVDC transmission, and they're moving another, I add the two together, 85 gigawatts of power across those lines. So China has a huge demand for energy, and you can see that in what's happening with their transmission system. So we break our project up into phases. So phase one would essentially be a 2,000 megawatt power plant at the North Slope. To put it into perspective, the new South Central power plant that MLMP and Shugach built is about 380 megawatts, I believe. So the average load across the entire state of Alaska is only about 850 megawatts. So we're talking about something that's significantly larger than that, because right now the North Slope oil producers are on their own power. So this would allow them to have that energy.
Just please let the record reflect that Representative Fields has joined us. Thank you for that. Has there been interest from industry up there at all in something like this, or has it just not been broached really?
Well, no, we have actually spoken with all the major producers, and there is interest. The equipment that is being used in the North Slope right now is very old. It's also extremely inefficient. The challenge that we have to deal with, however, is that the gas that they're using is essentially free to them, so efficiency doesn't matter. We think it's emissions that's going to drive that decision, but I think if there were an option offered to them to be able to utilize energy from somebody other than themselves, that they would be very eager to take advantage of that. So it's been one of those situations where the producers don't want to get in the way of an administration that wants to develop a gas pipeline. And, you know, there's been some political pressures for the last several years. That's always a moving target. But I do believe that if this were to come to fruition, there would be a lot of interest on the North Slope. So the numbers that I use for capital costs, I'm actually what we've done is we've looked at large scale developments in the lower 48. And we take that value and we multiply it by 1.5 times to reflect an Alaska reality, and so that's where we come up with these numbers. So these are very much back of the envelope numbers. They say that we can build this project for $2.5 billion, and if you plug in $3 a 1,000 cubic foot gas, you can produce power for about 5 cents a kilowatt hour. And these are all tested numbers, so that works. And then we talk about, as phase two, you build HVDC transmission line to Fairbanks. That would supply additional power for Golden Valley Electric, potentially enough power to provide space heat, because the cost of that energy would be so modest that it would be able to displace diesel and or $18 gas for heat, potentially. The capital cost of a transmission line to Fairbanks, about 400 miles, is about $1.65 billion. And so we take the 5-cent power that we started out with at the North Slope, we add another penny and a half for the cost of that transmission, and that comes to 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour. And by comparison, $18 an MCF gas at an 85% efficiency level in the home translates to about 7.2 cents a kilowatt hour. So that you can see that we're 10% better than that. So obviously that's a viable option. A phase three would take that HVDC transmission to the West Coast, potentially to Kotzebue, to Nome, potentially to the Bethel area, to the Ambler Mining District, and various other projects that are developing there. It would also open up the ability to bring in wind power from the West Coast, because there's a vast resource there that cannot be utilized right now because you don't have a load for it. But if you have an avenue to move that renewable power, then it becomes feasible to develop that. So we take that HVDC transmission. We estimate its cost at $900 million. Again, you're moving a smaller amount of electricity, so the cost of the transmission is a little bit lower. And then we add the delivered cost of power from Fairbanks at 6.5 cents, and we add 10 cents if you're only using 40% of the generation of the transmission capacity. That brings that power in at 17.2 cents. But if you're using capacity 85% of the capacity of that line, then it's 12 cents delivered cost of power. So you can see that that beats the value of diesel, and diesel is all that's used right now in that area, so it makes it feasible. These costs, I will tell you, are all predicated upon the entire cost of construction being funded by investors, as it were. So we're actually using 30-year money at 7%, and that's where we come up with our cost of money. If we're able to do better than that in any way, those costs just keep coming down, because the largest chunk of the costs here are the cost of money. So the YK area?
Quick question. On slide 16,
mm-hmm.
The $900 million line that would go to the West Coast, would that be from the plant on the North Slope, or would it, and how many miles about would that be?
This, Chairman Hopkins, this actually is coming from the Fairbanks area. Okay. So we're looking at doing it from Fairbanks as opposed to doing it from the North Slope itself. And that is an option to go over the top. Those would all have to be weighed out in the analysis to see what's the most practical route to take. But it's starting off with Fairbanks power at the 6.5 cents. So again, we're looking at the YK area, the same exercise we did for the West Coast, and you can see where we wind up with potentially a delivered cost of power at under 10 cents if we use 85% of the capacity of that transmission.
Can I ask a question on that? So would this be an alternative to building a gas line in terms of delivering power to the Donlin?
Representative Fields, for the chair, it could be an alternative. We have talked with Don and Gold about this. Their challenge is that they had to have something that they could nail down, and which is why they are developing they're trying to permit the gas pipeline. They are still looking at $1 billion to build that pipeline. So if this were to become a possibility in the next few years, and it can because it's a very fast project to build, it would probably persuade them to go this route instead. But that is a business decision that they have to make. There, I know that when they were looking at their analysis in 2011, the last analysis they did was in 2011, they needed to have energy at about 12 cents a kilowatt hour in order for their project to be feasible. And we believe we can deliver it to them for less than that, which would make it very attractive. And then phase five, which is essentially the last phase, is bringing that HVDC down to South Central. It would supplement what is available over here. We've got the costs laid out here. I just know that since I came to Anchorage 21 years ago, my cost of power was less than 8 cents a kilowatt hour when I moved there. It's now almost 20 cents a kilowatt hour. So if we can do something to stop that increase, that would be nice. 20 cents does not do anything for economic development. So here we come up with what that cost would be for that additional chunk. Again, we're going Fairbanks, and then we're adding the cost of the transmission from Fairbanks to Anchorage, and that brings in the power at potentially 8.7 cents a kilowatt hour.
Yes. Aren't we overbuilt on capacity in South Central right now because of the lack of
competition,
coordination among the different utilities?
I don't actually think we're overbuilt, because the situation you have is that this gas-fired generation is aging, and so you have a lot of plant that's aged out, and so this is essentially replacing aged plant without adding a lot of capacity. What I will speak to a little bit later is that what's happening here is that we're keeping a lid on demand because we just don't have the ability to serve at an affordable cost very large potential users. And so this is an optional way to actually bring affordable power to developers that can't afford to buy the power that we have today.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. So over a decade or two, we might see a shift in the generation from gas and Anchorage to gas on the North Slope with transmission down. Is that kind of how it would play out?
It could play out that way, but in a transmission grid, you want to have several sources of power feeding into the grid.
Sure.
So it would always be a good thing to have contributors from elsewhere in the rail belt. So you're not mothballing any generation. You're simply supplementing what they have, and you're putting, you know, the most efficient generation online to serve customers current and future. It's the future customers that we don't know of, but we do know of, that we're trying to look for here.
Another follow-up. Thanks for helping me understand this. So I guess that just makes me wonder, is gas-generated electricity more economical on the North Slope or Anchorage, or is that unknown?
I think it's a fair question, and I would posit to you that it's much more economical to develop it on the North Slope for the simple reason that the cost of gas in Cook Inlet is expensive because the demand is relatively low, and so the cost for the producers there is pretty high. And I believe that right now the utilities are buying gas on the order of $7 to $8 an MCF, whereas Henry Hub right now is below $3. And so you could expect at the North Slope that you would only be paying Henry Hub or less, especially if the primary beneficiaries are going to be the producers. There are many iterations that make it much more cost effective to generate up there. So moving gas by wire, in our opinion, is far more practical than moving gas by pipe. So when you add the projects together, we have, this still has the gigawatts in it. I changed it to megawatts to be consistent, but it's okay. We all understand a gigawatt is 1,000 megawatts. So this just looks at two iterations of phases 1 through 5, how many kilowatt hours we could produce and sell. If you look at the top half of this particular slide, the current sales of electricity in Alaska, retail sales, are actually 6.3 billion kilowatt hours. And what I like to point out to people is that in Sacramento, which is a municipal utility, in that town, that area, they sell 14 billion kilowatt hours. At least they did 2 years ago. It's probably more than that now. So we sell less than half as much electricity in the entire state of Alaska as Sacramento does. And we have all this potential industrial load here that is not being supported. And so this is what we want to correct here by having adequate energy to supply for those uses. So what was under consideration when we put this together were, and these are still potentially on the line, you've got the Susitna project, you've got Susitna access, you've got the transmission upgrades that the rail bed needs, you have the Fairbanks liquid natural gas trucking operation that is still under consideration, and you've got the bullet line. I do not have in here the gas pipeline, the $45 billion pipeline. That's something that can, that'll happen when it happens anyway, and it doesn't impact what's going on in Alaska as a whole. Here are the recent utility projects that you spoke to, Representative Fields. We've basically added about 200 megawatts of capacity altogether at a cost of about $1 billion because of the need to replace aging plant. It's just one of those things that you have to do it every 30 or 40 years. And so we have not created additional capacity, and no, I don't believe we're overbuilt, and I believe that these projects will all have an avenue to continue to succeed. So here are some potential unmet utility energy needs. We've got North Slope operations, we've got the gas turbines that could be converted, we've got pipeline operations, and we know for a fact that the pipeline, Alyeska Pipeline, for example, would like to buy electricity from the utilities and not have to generate their own. And so, you know, those are lost loads for us right now. You've got various mining projects that are underway. We've got the processors. We have fish processors across the state that are generating their own electricity at very high expense. And it's making our fish uncompetitive. And so that's something that we want to try and address. Server farms, there's a lot of interest in server farms up here. I mean, I had a phone call last week from somebody that wanted to know if I had surplus power because they wanted to run an electric operation for a small server farm. They only wanted 25 megawatts, and I told them I didn't have no 25 megawatts for them. Not today, not tomorrow, possibly not ever. But these are potential additional loads that are out there that if we create an environment that fosters their development, they would exist.
Sorry, maybe I'm missing. So you're saying that Naknek King Salmon, that concentration of processors, is a potentially a feasible place to bring this energy?
Through the chair, Representative Fields. Yes, it is feasible. What's going on right now in Bristol Bay is they're trying to develop a project there that would serve them locally. This project does not provide an HVDC line to every nook and cranny of Alaska. It can't do that. It's not practical. It's not cost effective. So what you do when you set up this program is you also create a program so that all other places in Alaska would essentially benefit from probably a postage stamp or electric rate, so that it wouldn't really matter what they're using to generate. They would all be sort of roped into this project, and PCE would essentially go away because it would not be needed any longer. But what I'm talking about is doing value-added processing in this state. Instead of shipping out, right now we fish out, ship in the raw, and we need to change that reality. And it's all over the state. It's not just the Bristol Bay area.
Well, this is really interesting. So I'm aware of Naknek King Salmon in terms of a large concentration of processing plants.
Right.
Are there others that kind of spring to mind as potential beneficiaries of this project?
You've got the whole Aleutian Chain project. There's a lot of projects over there. In Dutch Harbor is, I think, the largest or the second largest fishing port in the world. And so the fish is basically shipped. You don't buy product from Alaska, finished in Alaska. There was a small project in Cordova, probably still is, where North Pacific producers had implemented two or three really very cool value-added processes in Cordova itself. That's the sort of thing I want to see happen more of, because that creates year-round employment. You're taking your product, you're freezing it so that you have year-round ability to handle that product, and then you become, you know, the fish supplier of the world from Alaska, not from China, which is what's happening now. So this slide, you know, the question is, how much gas would we need? Using the figures of the 235 trillion cubic feet of known and projected reserves, what this takes you to is if you go down to the very bottom where you have a 5 gigawatt project, Remember that 5 gigawatts is basically about 6 or 7 times what Alaska is using today. It would use 6.8 trillion cubic feet in 30 years. So it's a very tiny fraction of the gas that's there. So essentially what I'm saying is we can have our cake and eat it too. So connecting Alaska, we reduce the number of power plants across the state. We consolidate loads. That makes interconnection more feasible. When we have a transmission grid, we make renewable projects more feasible. You can put in multi-hundred megawatts of renewables and be able to feed them across the state if you have a channel to be able to move them. So essentially what I'm saying is let's ship made in Alaska and not pieces of Alaska. That's what we're doing today. We treat ourselves like a colony state, and that has to stop. So here's a pathway to do that. And that wraps my presentation.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Kohler. One of the questions I had was, how is redundancy in the lines built into this plan?
Well, as I pointed out, on a DC transmission grid, each wire is capable of operating independently. It actually is considered more reliable than AC transmission because you do have that degree of redundancy. The primary manufacturers and installers of DC are ABB and Siemens, and they essentially guarantee, I think it's 98.5% availability, which no AC transmission can do. So it's you can have multiple runs. You can see where we had the two side-by-side lines. That gives you essentially 4 degrees of redundancy. You're not going to have the entire both lines go down at the same time. You may have one pole go down or one tower go down. You still have the others. And so you build those lines with adequate capacity to be able to move a great deal more than, for example, 25% that you're shipping. It would be more like you could move 75% of what's being demanded at any point in time down one wire. So it is an extremely reliable way to transmit power. Alyeska pipeline, coming from the North Slope, there'd be parts of it that you would bury for avalanche areas. There are parts of it that'd be above ground. You don't have quite the issue that you do with seismic vulnerability with a pipeline. You don't have that with transmission lines as much. So it's the avalanches that you worry about, and that's what you work towards. So it's merely a matter of designing it robustly enough so that you can withstand most of those natural events.
And then, anybody else have a question? So it would go to, the lines would go to some of the more regional hubs in rural Alaska, and then would there be smaller lines that would go out to neighboring villages in the area to help bring that power? You were talking about a postage stamp rate, but would there be a way to feed smaller lines out or?
So what we're doing right now, of course, is we're connecting villages, and we're using AC to connect. We have been working through the Alaska Center for Energy and Power and another company called Princeton Power, which is an offshoot of Princeton University, on developing a smaller conversion system. So in other words, you can do 1 megawatt or 500 kilowatts of DC so that you can actually connect longer distances using essentially single wire direct current lines. At present, we only contemplate going DC to a hub because you're going to have a conversion station at each point. And so you convert it to AC at the hub and then you move it via AC. Typically, your distances aren't so long that you can't cover it with AC, but As this concept continues to evolve, DC is used a lot in military installations, and we believe there's going to be a DC small-scale conversion system that's going to be available very soon. And then it may be more practical to send it longer distances. The challenge you always run into is when you see a transmission line marching across the countryside, you think that every community along the way is benefiting from that and they can get power from it. But they can't because that's very high voltage. And in order for it to be converted to a voltage that we can use in our homes and businesses, you have to have a substation with large transformers. And that can't be justified for every small community. So what you'll find is that they're being fed backwards from hubs. even though they're right by the transmission line, it's not feasible to actually have a substation just for them. So that's the same thing you do with DC.
That's the question. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of ignorance about electricity. So if you had a large plant on the North Slope and an HVDC line going down to Anchorage, what does that infrastructure look like to convert to AC in, say, Fairbanks? And does having, I don't know, for lack of a better term, offtake spurs, does that impact the efficiency of transmitting some of that energy further down the line to Anchorage? And if so, how much do you lose?
So the rule of thumb for losses over distance, it's about 4%, which is about the same as for a gas pipeline. It's typically a little higher for AC because you have to continually step up the voltage of the AC transmission. So it's within the rule of thumb for what you would expect for losses. You don't have to correct the quality of the power for DC. And then when you get to the conversion station, that is essentially an electronic conversion station. So what has happened in the last 30 years is as semiconductor technology has improved and computers have improved, and my iPhone right now is 100 times more powerful than my first computer that I bought for $8,000 back in 1998. So, you know, that's the same technology that's used in the conversion stations. So that has come down dramatically. And so what we had been looking at working with Princeton Power was a single 500 kVA transformer, two of those, so that you could do AC to DC on one end, a DC line, and then DC to AC on the other end, so it could serve the communities. And that is technically completely feasible. I just haven't laid my sticky fingers on one yet.
So you'd be looking at a 4% loss from North Slope to Anchorage, regardless of weather and how many additional points there were, Fairbanks, Willow, whatever.
Right. That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank you for coming, and I want to thank Chair Hopkins for hosting this. It was my suggestion after our conversation that we have this hearing. I think that it's interesting after all the many years of conversations that we've had about mm-hmm. the gas pipeline. When you think about the price tag associated with that gas pipeline, that there's a possibility of a much lower cost mm-hmm. alternative that could not only help us monetize that resource, but also help us provide access to energy for that swath of Alaska that are highly underserved right now is pretty exciting. And you know, just to reiterate for the 10 people that are listening right now, but this is a very important audience in the room, that the first, you know, the phases that would get gas converted into electricity on the North Slope and then transmission to Fairbanks, the YK, the West Coast, and to South Central, all total $6.76 billion, mm-hmm. which is just a tiny fraction of the, you know, $45 billion-ish number that we've been talking about, the gas pipeline, mm-hmm. which wouldn't actually distribute energy to most of those communities. So I think, you know, it's exciting that that there's another alternative, that the technology is changing enough to make mm-hmm. this more feasible right now is pretty exciting, and I appreciate your coming. I do hope that we can get a little more attention on the potential to convert gas into, you know, energy and electric energy and distribute it, because of the potential that it means. And I just want to sort of underscore one other thing you mentioned earlier that was sort of referenced, and that is that getting energy to parts of rural Alaska creates other economic development opportunities. And you've cited a bunch of mining opportunities, but I would also add that, you know, my brother-in-law worked in fishing in the Bristol Bay region for a very long time, and one of the big challenges they had was freezing their fish. Absolutely. And figuring out how to process fish out there mm-hmm. to create a stronger economy and improve the value of that right. product. Right. And what they really needed was energy. Right. They just needed electricity to cool
and
the fish. Yeah.
To respond to that, respond holds for the chair. I was actually just in NACNEC a couple of days ago, and they've just installed two large new generators, mm-hmm. And the purpose of those generators at 3.3 megawatts each mm-hmm. is to serve the processing industry, and you know the processing industry operates for an almighty 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. So you know they're putting in $14 million to be able to serve an 8-week load, mm-hmm. So that they can do the good quality freezing processing that needs to occur. They used to put a whole bunch of fish into cans, mm-hmm. and I'm just saying there's not a lot of profit in that. The thing I do want to point out is that the larger gas project, the gas pipeline, the primary purpose of that is to export the gas, and this project doesn't do that. But I will tell you that when this concept originated in the state was back in the very early 90s when ARCO Alaska was in fact developing this project. They called it Project Eel because they were going to put in this submersible cable that was going to go from the North Slope to California, and it was going to move 20 gigawatts of power mm-hmm. that they were going to create with gas at the North Slope. And the challenge, of course, is that I'm not sure how the state gets a royalty or some other fashion of compensation from a project like that. But this could absolutely include the exportation of electricity, and the state could get its share through some sort of a state tax on the electricity that's being shipped out of state. Mm-hmm. I think that there are other avenues to monetize that are going to be quite attractive.
The legislature is always willing to find a way to monetize these things. Thank you.
You had talked early on about having private funding for mm-hmm. the lines, and I think you said the power plant as well. Mm-hmm. What role did you see the state playing in this effort?
The state, in my opinion, needs to take a primary lead in similar to what they've done for the Interior Gas Utility, where they test the feasibility of the project and serves as a lead permitting agency. I mean, you're going to have to do a lot of permitting to get your rights of way and to develop these lines, and so they can serve as the aggregator, and that gives the project credibility. It gives the investors a sense of credibility as well, that they've got a state player that's involved at a high level, because this is, you know, whether it's $6 billion or $2 billion or $40 billion, it's a huge project, and so it needs to be managed by professionals. And so, you know, I see the state as taking a lead in doing a feasibility analysis and then working with the key players to pull together a pathway forward. Because all of these end users, the Donlin Creeks and potentially, you know, the Live and Good and the Ambler Mining District and all these others, if they know that the state is involved in a project like this, they will shelve their self-production ideas and look towards this project to supply them. As I said, the costs that we have predicated over here are completely independent of any state funding. They don't contemplate state grants or state participation or anything like that. But we can certainly do better than 7% money. And so that's where the state begins to play a role. You know, they can put out bonds, they can bring together large investors, they can make this happen much more economically viably than we can.
Great. And then I had a legislative research report done recently that said there'd been 80 different energy plans since I was born in 1983. Has this been incorporated into any looking at that, looking how it might work with the long-term energy plan? You said it was last looked in the 90s with ARCO. Has mm-hmm. it been, as far as you know, incorporated into any plans or as an alternative or anything like that?
No. They're really, I mean, the last sort of energy plan that we had was the 2006 effort by this committee. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, basically put together some euphemistic goals and targets. But it didn't actually put together a step-by-step plan. And that's what I think we need in this state, is we need to have something concrete. I think the last real energy study that the state did was probably the 1981 Stone and Webster report, when we identified the key hydro projects that were then developed and then threw up our hands and said there's nothing for rural Alaska, so PCE is going to be mm-hmm. the only game in town. That's probably the last major energy plan that was done.
Makes sense. I know there's been a lot of smaller ones that have been done. Some of those were incorporated yep. into the gas utility ones in the Susitna in the late or in the early 2000s.
Right, and right. They were all local.
Yeah.
Local or very small regional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or the Energy Atlas that was run as well, or any right. other version of that.
I got $5,000 in that too.
There you go. Anybody have any other questions? Any other things?
You had a long floor session.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're all tired.
Busy day.
I'm available anytime.
What are the next steps if we're looking at doing something like this?
You know, one of the things that I sent to you was something that I had brought to the previous administration as a potential appointing a commission or blue ribbon committee of some kind to actually sit down and put together an energy plan that's realistic for Alaska and that looks towards economically enhancing what we have, not just same old, same old. That's a possibility. We could potentially maybe do a resolution. Maybe you can direct ADA to work on developing a comprehensive Alaska energy plan that includes large-scale generation and transmission across the state. We need a grid. And so if we charge them with doing that, maybe they'll actually get it done.
Would we need to require utilities to purchase this gas and to utilize it when it becomes available in terms of, you know, economic
I think this is one of those situations where if you offer them a product that they can't say no to, they can't say no to it. But you make it in such a fashion that it enhances what they're doing. We don't want anybody to feel like they're going to have to eat, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of investment. That's not what this is going to do. I think what needs to happen is that the utilities have to have some sort of assurance that they can collect their fixed costs through whatever process they have. You know, we collect our fixed costs through our non-fuel charges, and that is a mechanism that can be done. So we need to look at different iterations of how do we make this palatable and cost-effective for all Alaskans. I mean, I will tell you, 20 cent power is not feasible. We need to do better than that, and that's true in the rail belt. You know, Anchorage is at 20 cents, Fairbanks is at 23 or 24 cents. That does not do anything for economic development. We need to change that.
Agreed.
So we'd be delighted to work with you on how do we move forward from here.
Excellent. Well, we would be too as well. Final questions? Final comments? All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Kohler. Special Committee on Energy will meet next week on Thursday, April 25th, to hear from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska regarding ongoing efforts to modernize the Alaska Railroad electric grid.
Ta-da!
Timely. As there's no further business to come today in front of the committee, this meeting will adjourn at 1:18 p.m.